This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of December 11th, 2022. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 268. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. The Is It Just Me commentary. I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. And the big deal feature. Professor and author Jules Boykoff joins me from Portland, Oregon, to talk greenwashing and sportwashing, the Qatar 2022 World Cup, the delay in awarding the 2030 Winter Olympics, and more. But first, is it just me? Is it just me, or should Adrian Dix have remained BC's Minister of Health? Premier David Eby kept Dix in the job in his December 7th announced cabinet, despite the ongoing crisis in BC hospitals as we approach the third anniversary of COVID-19. A report commissioned by the NDP government about its response to the pandemic was finally released on December 2nd, but reporters got only 45 minutes notice, and Solicitor General Mike Farnworth answered questions only by phone. The Lessons Learned report pointed to a lack of transparency and an abundance of miscommunication. Quote, there was strict central control of the messaging, including actively discouraging any questioning or challenging of the provincial health officer, Dr. Bonnie Henry. It continued, the public just wanted certainty and were not prepared for continuous change. As a result, many interpreted changes to guidance as evidence of earlier mistakes, damaging trust. Efforts should be made to build tolerance for uncertainty and ongoing change. End quote. Is this all BC is going to get? Why is the NDP so scared of scrutiny? After the 2003 SARS pandemic, Ontario hired a judge to hold a public inquiry. Dr. Lynn Filiatro, a retired Vancouver General Hospital emergency physician, is with the Protect Our Province BC Coalition. She told me that the Lessons Learned report was a disappointment in so many ways.
Like I said, this is not independent. This scopes creep. They went outside of assessing the government response. They assessed the pandemic response based on indicators that, in my mind, are not the correct indicator, and with useless data, which is the data that BC has. Mm-hmm. Based on under-testing, under-reporting. So, yes, there should be an independent review. What that looks like, I'm not sure. But it needs to. We need to start with some goal setting. If we're going to spend the time, the energy, and the money on doing an independent review, there has to be concrete, binding, actionable goals, as opposed to this 150 pages, which to me doesn't leave me with a lot of clarity as to what is the government going to do with this. So whatever the process needs to be independent, there needs to be multiple stakeholders and also multiple science experts. You know, we had in BC a lot of people that could have been brought in to help, and instead the pattern of this province has been, we're going to tell you what to do. It's top down. Mm-hmm. And who knows what were their goals, but certainly they weren't clear to anybody, and the decision-making wasn't clear to anybody. So I'm hoping there'll be something, but again, if there is something, it's a lot of time and energy. It can't just collect dust on a shelf.
That was Dr. Lynn Filiatro of Protect Our Province, BC. What do you think? Email Bob at thebreaker.news. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. Large sporting events often claim to be carbon neutral, but often this assertion is greenwashing, and it hides the incredible amount of pollution they actually create. Governments, sports bodies such as FIFA and their corporate partners continue to get away with it because there is almost no independent oversight and thus little accountability. Those are lines from The World Cup in Qatar is a Climate Catastrophe in Scientific American by my guest, Jules Boykoff. Jules Boykoff joins me from Portland, Oregon, where he is the Politics and Government Professor at Pacific University and the author of No Olympians, Inside the Fight Against Capitalist Mega Sports in Los Angeles, Tokyo, and Beyond. Qatar has spent $220 billion U.S. dollars on stadiums and other infrastructure to host a million guests, many flying in from around the world.
Jules, Qatar 2022 and the next World Cup, North America in 2026, is it possible to stage a carbon neutral sports mega event, or is this business model doomed to harm the environment?
Well, because these mega events have become so huge, they suffer from what a lot of people call gigantism. It's incredibly difficult to envision an actual green games. And there's a really good research study done by Sven Daniel Wolf and colleagues that has charted the rise of the size of these sports mega events like the Men's World Cup and the Winter and Summer Olympics, and found that since 1960, they've increased massively. That not only has brought more athletes into the fold, but it's increased the carbon footprint. So it's really difficult to envision one, especially if you're not going to rely on carbon offsets, which has been one of the main mechanisms we've seen with the Qatar World Cup in terms of how they've justified calling their event green. FIFA has actually said that the Qatar World Cup is a fully carbon neutral event, which is pretty striking and made a lot of people in the environmental community think twice and raise eyebrows. I mean, there's a study by Carbon Market Watch that found that actually when it came to estimating the amount of emissions around the stadiums alone, that the FIFA and the Qatar organizers had underestimated the carbon footprint by some eightfold. That's not even to talk about the fact that there's enormous resources in terms of water that goes into creating these pitches and making them all look ready to go for the games. There's not just the eight fields where we've been watching all these matches transpire, but there's more than 130 practice pitches. Each one of them requires some 50,000 liters of water. And because there's so little groundwater in Qatar and surface water, a lot of this is desalinated water, which comes with its own carbon footprint. And so it goes on and on and on. When you think about the emissions from the flights, you have a lot of people just flying in and out of Qatar to watch the games. Basically, the Qatar World Cup is shaping up to be a quintessential greenwash on many fronts. And this is really common when it comes to these sports mega events where FIFA or the International Olympic Committee like to talk a big green game, but then when it comes to crunch time, they have very dubious measures. This is classic greenwashing.
Yeah, they've spent the equivalent of $220 billion U.S. dollars to build stadiums and other infrastructure, so up to a million people can visit for the World Cup, mostly flying from around the world. That has an impact on carbon emissions as well. Qatar has used this as also a platform to do big LNG deals, to announce big LNG deals with China and Germany. They're now making noises about bidding for 2036 Summer Olympics.
This LNG thing is massive, Bob. I'm glad you mentioned that, because basically Qatar is sitting on an LNG time bomb when it comes to climate change. And if they actually use all the liquefied natural gas that they have access to, that'll take us far beyond the 1.5 degrees that we're trying to limit warming to at this point. And so that just points to this sports washing dynamic, where not only is it about the event itself, but sports washing allows the country or city that hosts these games to cut all sorts of deals moving forward. And liquefied natural gas deals are at the top of the list. And this is doomsday for the rest of us. This is doomsday when it comes to climate change, but it's just regular old business when it comes to these sports mega events.
So we saw the human rights of the migrant workers infringed, the massive deaths, workplace deaths that are preventable for the migrant workers from poorer countries in Southeast Asia. There's also the laws against the harming the rights of LGBTQ people that have been highlighted by several of the teams in silent protests, like the German team. This is a country which is definitely not a free country that where the people enjoy the same freedoms that you and I do in the West.
Absolutely. And it looks like we have the International Olympic Committee that's going to potentially overlook all of that yet again and consider Qatar for a potential Olympic bid. We both know how these things work as two people who followed these kind of machinations for quite a while. When you show the rulers of sport around the world that you can host one of these big events, it signals that you're ready to host another one. And you pointed out something that not enough people are really talking about, is that they've built up these stadiums. There's eight FIFA level stadiums, but Qatar really doesn't have that big of a league. Now they're going to take apart one of the stadiums. It's going to be a temporary stadium, but, and they're going to reduce the size of some of these others. By the way, that all comes with the carbon footprint, all that construction. But even so, you're going to have these fairly sizable stadiums without real sports use moving forward. And so if you can argue that you're going to host something like the Olympics or another big regional sports event, well, then you can justify the spending, you can justify the carbon footprint. And that's what exactly we're seeing in Qatar as they move out of the World Cup.
The next World Cup in 2026 is in the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. Some of the host cities include Toronto, Seattle, and Vancouver. FIFA is floating a trial balloon to expand the 48-nation 80-match tournament. Instead of 16 groups of three teams each in the opening round, it foresees a possibility of 12 groups of four teams, which would mean two dozen more games, another burden for taxpayers. In Toronto, they're spending $290 million for five matches. In Vancouver, the bill is at least $260 million.
What do you think of the prospects for the 2026 World Cup to be hosted in North America when it comes to the issues that are facing other host countries?
Yeah, well, first, they're going to make the tournament bigger, like you're saying, 48 teams. And this conforms to that trend I mentioned earlier that these academics had researched where these events are only getting bigger and bigger. And FIFA likes to say it's because, hey, we can include more countries in this. It'll be more of an international festival. But we all know that a lot of it does come down to money. So it wouldn't surprise me in the slightest if FIFA were to increase the number of games, reduce the number of groups, and we're going to see all sorts of travel. I mean, that's the one thing you can say about the Qatar World Cup is that it is in a fairly small geographical area. The travel from hotel to match and match to other match is pretty minimal. That's not going to be the case at all. When the World Cup comes to Canada, the United States, and Mexico, there's going to be a whole lot more additional flying around from venue to venue. You just can't get there quickly enough if you're on the train. And unfortunately, where I'm coming to you from, the United States, our train system just isn't that good. And so you're going to see a huge uptick in emissions just around that. In regards to the tourism factor, there's been a lot of good research on that as well. And what people have found is that there's a sort of tourism displacement effect. The people that normally would be there as tourists in the summer in Vancouver, in Los Angeles, San Francisco, they're going to stay away because the costs are going to go through the roof for hotels and whatnot. And so there's just going to be a swishing in of sports consumers and sports tourists and a swishing out of all the people that would otherwise have been there for the art, for the outdoor life and for all the other things that you would be a tourist in for Vancouver, Los Angeles, Seattle, what have you. And so it's a lot of different factors coming together with North America. The other one I think is going to be really interesting is after all this criticism of Qatar for its anti-LGBTQ positions, after all this criticism of Qatar for its migrant labor exploitation, we're going to see a lot of that coming back on the United States, for sure, where I'm coming to you from, which is to say Florida's hosting a match in Miami, many matches, and there's a don't say gay law there. Texas is holding matches in Dallas. They have some extraordinarily strict anti-woman, anti-abortion laws there. In Georgia, there's strong anti-trans legislation and sentiment swirling through the state. And so this is all going to come back for a discussion on the United States, unless we think that I'm talking whataboutism in some sort of way of dismissing all these things against Qatar. I'm absolutely not. We should be critiquing Qatar for the deaths of the migrant workers and the mistreatment of migrant workers. We should be critiquing Qatar for the way that LGBTQ people are treated, for the way that women are treated under this male guardianship law where they need a man's approval to do basic things like take a government job. We should be critical of that. But the field is going to be opened for critique of the United States. And hey, I'm telling you, we deserve it very much here as well. I haven't even talked about Guantanamo Bay yet. So that's going to be something I'm going to keep my eye on moving out of the Qatar World Cup and toward this one in Canada, United States, and Mexico, because there's plenty of people around the world that are really ready to be critiquing Canada and the United States. That's for sure.
Other big headlines in mega events last week, the International Olympic Committee delayed the awarding of the 2030 Winter Olympics indefinitely. Salt Lake City and Sapporo, Japan are in the running. The British Columbia government is refusing to financially support a Vancouver bid. The IOC says it's looking at possibly awarding the 2030 and 2034 Winter Games at the same time. It's also considering rotating the Games around cities that already have venues built. They say they're taking a pause for thought because of climate change, but there is a major corruption scandal in Japan involving the Tokyo 2020 Olympic Organizing Committee.
What do you think that is going through the minds of the International Olympic Committee by delaying this again and by coming back to the drawing board and making a rethink of how they host Winter Olympics?
Yeah, first of all, it's really an interesting time that we're in because, as you'll know, Bob, typically the Olympics are awarded 7 years in advance to give a city the requisite time to get ready. There has been a change in that recently where some cities have been handed the Olympics 11 years in advance in the case of Brisbane in Australia or Los Angeles here in the United States. But generally, it's thought in Olympic circles that you need about 7 years or so to get everybody on board politically and also get the money together, get the venues together, and so on. So I think the way to really consider this is, well, first of all, they're not inviting me into their private meetings, believe it or not. So I don't know for sure from firsthand experience. But as someone who's watched the Olympic movement for well over a decade now very carefully, I can tell you that oftentimes it's money that drives these decisions. And so it'd be pretty easy to throw Salt Lake City in for 2030 Olympics, the Winter Olympics. But, you know, the money side of it will be a little bit more complicated and tricky. The deals with the United States Olympic and Paralympic Committee would need to be rewritten and so on. And so you kind of want to try to avoid that if you're the International Olympic Committee. And so I think you're absolutely right. They're buying time to sort of let this scandal in Japan settle out. This is huge news in Japan, by the way, the scandal around the Olympics, this bribery scandal where companies were essentially buying their way into getting these deals around the Olympic Games. And some big names, including big names attached to one of the biggest companies in Japan, Dentsu, are being sucked into the vortex of this controversy. And so it'd be pretty tough to award it to Sapporo right now in the midst of all these scandals that has the entire population across Japan riled up. There's a significant anti-Olympics movement in Tokyo and also in Sapporo, and they're working together now to try to stave off getting the Olympics in 2030. And so by putting off this, the bid of decision, the IOC can sort of avoid that, hope that it all settles out and move on. They can also maybe hope that Vancouver can work out a deal. The bid seems to be dead in the water, but like you've said before, Bob, there's a chance that they could try to lean on the federal government. It's a very small chance, but it is a chance. And so this buying of time is much less about any kind of principles around climate change, although they did mention that in the meeting the other day. It's more about them preserving their money shuffle and for making sure that the money continues to flow in their direction. After all, they've been talking about climate change for decades upon decades now with very little consideration about the follow through. Earlier this year, they hosted the Olympics in Beijing using fake snow, which obviously has an environmental cost. They knocked down the Songshan Forest in a natural reserve area, putting all sorts of animals in danger. So this newfound, all of a sudden at the end of 2022, care about the environment, I think it deserves our healthy skepticism based on their track record.
Big news in professional women's soccer on both sides of the border. Canada is getting a women's pro league in 2025. The Vancouver Whitecaps say they'll be one of the franchises. National team captain Christine Sinclair says she wants to come home and play in the league. Sinclair's current club in the National Women's Soccer League is the Portland Thorns, which are for sale for a whopping $60 million.
Yeah, there's a lot in the mix. For your listeners who haven't been following what's been happening here in Portland, The background is that the owner of the team, Merrick Paulson, and his partial owner of the team, his dad, Henry Paulson, the former Treasury Secretary, have basically overseen a real toxic culture in the front office that has allowed for all manner of sexual abuse and even assault from a former coach. And they just looked the other way and sent him off on their best way. The culture inside of the organization is toxic. We've seen numerous revelatory studies and investigative reports coming out saying it's a terrible place to work. Finally, after enormous amount of pressure from the public, Merrick Paulson decided to fire his left and right hand man, Gavin Wilkinson, his longtime GM, and Mike Golub, who was doing a lot of the financial work for the team. That was a big deal when he fired those guys. I mean, those guys, he really relied on them. My point is just that he's been doing, Merrick Paulson has been doing the bare minimum every time. He keeps getting pressured, then he makes a move, keeps getting pressure, makes another move. Even after he fired those guys, then the move pressure came here in Portland for him to sell the teams. I say plural teams because he owns the Timbers and the Thorns, Timbers of MLS and the Thorns of the NWSL. Well, guess what? Now all of a sudden he's saying, all right, I'll sell one of the teams. And so for starters, there's all sorts of pressure on him to sell both teams. I mean, if he had a toxic work culture inside of the club for the Thorns, it also existed for the Timbers. And so there's a lot of movement there. There's zero effort, though, on the part of the commissioner of Major League Soccer, Don Garber, to try to force a sale. He's been in really tight, the Paulsons are, with Garber. But here in Portland, I'll tell you, people are really excited about the possibility of having a publicly owned franchise, at least in part. And it's not necessarily just a pipe dream. The two groups that I think are most interesting that have emerged here in Portland to purchase the Thorns and or the Timbers. One is a group of former Nike executives, most of them women, who are putting their funds together to try to purchase the team. The other group is a group called Onward Rose City, which it's a publicly owned kind of venture led by private equity people who really know what they're doing on the money front. And they've set up a website and taken in sort of donations, if you will, like promised donations of shares you might like to buy. And so there's a lot of motion in the Portland ocean to try to get these teams to be at least partially publicly owned. And so despite the high $60 million price tag, that still could be in the offing. And that could be quite interesting moving forward. In terms of Christine Sinclair, yes, absolute Portland legend. Not only is she a star of the Thorns, but she went to college at the University of Portland, where she was a star. So just a Portland star through and through. She was on the bench at the end of the last season in some of the key games. And so she's kind of at the twilight of her career, perhaps at the highest of levels. But I'm sure if she were to leave for Canada, everybody in here in Portland would absolutely understand that that would be a pretty exciting swan song for her being involved in a women's professional league there. So I think almost no matter what she does, she's going to be in the goodwill of Portlanders. Even when she did some social media output the last week or so in support of Merrick Paulson, and a lot of people here were cringing about that and really holding their tongues because she's so beloved, wondering why the heck she would say all these positive things about Merrick Paulson, who's pretty unpopular here in town. And yet she did that, and that just shows what of icon status she has, if she can get away with that in this tough town.
That was my guest, Jules Boykoff, joining me from Portland, Oregon, where he is the politics and government professor at Pacific University, and he's also the author of No Olympians, Inside the Fight Against Capitalist Mega Sports in Los Angeles, Tokyo, and Beyond. News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. In the Taiwan news, China bans fish exports from Taiwan, approves only one application. Taiwan Council of Agriculture confirms news, fish industry in shock. The main items that China banned include the Pacific sari, four-finger threadfin, squid, mahi-mahi, and tuna. The COA said the incident is linked to China's demand to the world, made in April 2021, that any item exported to the country must be registered. In Kyoto news, Japan billionaire Maezawa says K-pop star and seven others to join Moon Trip. K-pop artist Top and American DJ Steve Aoki will be among the eight crew members who will join him on a private space trip to orbit the moon in 2023. Maezawa became the first Japanese civilian to travel to the International Space Station last year. They will ride on a spaceship being developed by U.S. firm SpaceX. In Hong Kong Free Press, more than 1,300 people sent to correctional institutions so far over 2019 Hong Kong protests. Security Secretary Chris Tang said 345 of the 1,315 sent to correctional institutions over the protests were aged 21 and under. As of the end of October, a total of 677 people in custody had taken part in the Project PATH program, launched in November last year to help, quote, rebuild positive values, end quote. The figure included 474 convicted of protest-related offenses. The program focuses on Chinese history to enhance a sense of national identity. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest. On Coin TV, Oregon, Washington substations intentionally attacked. After authorities said someone intentionally shot and damaged two power stations in North Carolina, cutting electricity to tens of thousands of families, News Nation obtained a federal memo warning about similar attacks in the Pacific Northwest. Both PGE and Pacific Power confirmed to Coin 6 News they are aware of these issues. Federal authorities have warned that the power grid could be a prime target for extremist groups that embrace accelerationism, a fringe philosophy that promotes mass violence to fuel society's collapse. In King 5, first recorded moose sighting ever in Mount Rainier National Park. As of 2015, there were an estimated 5,000 moose living in Washington state. Most live in the Selkirk Mountains, with smaller numbers living in the North Cascades, Okanagan, and the Blue Mountains. Moose have been known to wander farther south into the high desert of the Columbia Basin. Moose in Washington state belong to a subspecies called Shiras moose, which are smaller than the moose found in Canada and Alaska. In the Times Colonist, bring water and flush less, Mount Washington tells visitors amid water shortage. Resort visitors are being asked to bring their own bottled water and reduce the number of toilet flushes after the springs that produce the resort's potable water supply slowed to record low production. The island is experiencing the worst drought levels in more than 15 years. Snowpack in the upper watershed is less than 25% of what is considered normal for this time of year. That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. It don't matter what color you are. The virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting. Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to all the people behind the Pan Pacific Christmas Wish Breakfast in Vancouver. The 35th annual edition is December 14th at the Pan Pacific Vancouver at Canada Place from 6 a.m. to 9 a.m. Donate toys to the Lower Mainland Christmas Bureau. Get a delicious breakfast. Easy as that. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of December 11th, 2022. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 11th of December in 1972, Apollo 17, the sixth and final U.S. Apollo mission to land on the moon? Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit TheBreaker.News on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/TheBreakerNews. That's patreon.com/TheBreakerNews. Until next week.